Hello and welcome to Written in Uncertainty, an Elder Scrolls podcast sat firmly in the grey maybe of Tamriel. My name is Aramithius, and this week we're picking up a request from Songbird in the Written in Uncertainty Discord and looking at the Father of the Niven text, which is a text all about Topal the Explorer, who was pretty much the best character that we have from the Mirithic era, who first discovered Tamriel, if what we're led to believe is true, and it's an analysis of the fragmentary poem that we have about him. So in a way, a lot of the commentary that I'm going to be giving is going to be coming from the text itself, although it's still worth bearing in mind some of the foibles of the author and the fact that the author of the text itself doesn't really know everything. So the text itself is called Father of the Niven and is translated with commentary by Florin Jalil. I don't know quite how old it's supposed to be, or this translation I mean, because it's present in the Elder Scrolls Online as well. There's a few little tweaks here and there to bring it up to date. As we read through this version, you'll see that it talks about Worgen Jarth, and Worgen Jarth didn't exist at the time of ESO, so I think this text is primarily intended to be a third era piece of analysis, which puts it at quite some distance to the events that it's actually talking about. So let's kick off. Introduction. Writing the biography of anyone is a challenge. Usually the problem lies in assessing one's sources, comparing the prejudices of one chronicle versus another. Worgen Jarth, I've been told, in writing his well-regarded series of The Wolf Queen of Solitude, used over 100 contemporary narratives. I cannot complain about my task having a similar issue. And the one thing I would raise with this is that Worgen Jarth, in looking at The Wolf Queen, would have had fairly unified perspectives on the Wolf Queen as a person, that pretty much everything we read about the Wolf Queen of Solitude says that she's a demon, that she's bad, that she's the very definition of evil in many ways. So I'm not sure that Worgen Jarth would have had that much of a problem unless he's trying to produce something that's particularly neutral, which, to be frank, his text doesn't wind up being, which may be the fault of the sources, I don't know. But to carry on with the stuff about Topal the Pilot, there is but one record of the man called Topal the Pilot, the earliest known Ultima explorer of Tamriel. Only four short verse fragments of the epic Father of the Niven have survived to the present day, but they offer an interesting, if controversial, look at the Middle Mirithic era when Topal the Pilot may have sailed the seas around Tamriel. This is a little interesting if you think about the impact that Topal has had on the geography of Tamriel. If you look at the stuff around Cyrodiil, the mouth of the Niven River is Topal Bay, and the name of the Niven River itself is derived from Topal's ship. I think it's therefore quite unlikely that this one text would have had that much of an impact on the culture and naming traditions around Cyrodiil. So I would expect, as well as this particular text and the maps that he's left behind in Firsthold, that there would also be some oral traditions and sayings attributed to him, or things that he did, little folk stories here and there, as well as what we have here. So Topal, in order to loom as large as he does in the geography of Tamriel, I think needs to have a bit more of an impact than this text perhaps gives him. Though Father of the Niven is the only written record of Topal the Pilot's voyages, it is not the only proof of his existence. Among the treasures of the great crystal tower of Somerset Isle are his crude but fascinating maps, his legacy to all Tamriel. The translation of the Ald Mhuire Uadhindre Nibenu, Father of the Niven, is my own, and I accept that other scholars may disagree with some of my choice of words. I cannot promise my translation lives up to the beauty of the original. I have only strived for simple coherence. And so we may have some translation issues with this. Unfortunately, the text that we have here doesn't really tell us where the more speculative elements of the translation lie, so we are simply going on Florin's own words here, and we can't really know where his ambiguities are, which is, I think, a bit of a shame. Fragment 1. second ship, the Pasquiniel, manned by pilot Ilio, was to follow the southern pointing waystone, and the third, the Nibben, manned by pilot Topal, was to follow the northeast pointing waystone. The orders from the Crystal Tower, they were to sail forth for 80 moons and then return to Tell. Only Nibben returned to Firsthold, laden high with gold and spice and fur and strange creatures, dead and alive. Though alas, old Elnafe Topal never found, he told the tales of the lands he had visited to the wonderment of all. For 66 days and nights he sailed, over crashing waves of dire intent, past whirlpools, through mist that burned like fire, until he reached the mouth of a great bay and he landed on a sun-kissed meadow of gentle dells. As he and his men rested, there came a fearsome howl, and hideous orcs streamed forth from the murky glen, cannibal teeth clotted with gore. Now, there are a few things here that I want to clarify before we go any further, really. The 80 moons in the first place. We don't really know how long that is, I don't think. There's the implication that it's something like 18 months, if you think about how moons affect the timing in our world. But we don't actually know, because we don't really have an accurate picture of how the moons of Tamriel work. So, if we're thinking something like it is in the real world, you're looking at something close to, and here my maths fails me, something like 8.5 years before he comes back, which is quite a time to spend away. And it may perhaps be shorter than that, though, given that you've got the two moons to count. So it maybe is anything up to half that time, but we don't know for sure. The text talks about old Elnafe as well. Old Elnafe is another term for Old Meris, the first place that all elves came from. This expedition that Topal is undertaking is an exercise to try and find the elves' lost homeland. And as it turns out, he didn't manage it, and nor did anyone else, which kind of links in with several of the other texts that point out that old Elnafe, Almeris, never really existed. If you listen to the episode of this podcast about the Anuad considers that the old Elnafe realm actually became Tamriel. And so we've got a very different perspective from that text compared to the traditional Murish attitude that old Elnafe was somewhere potentially to the south, although we don't know for sure. This particular direction that Topal sails in indicates that they haven't a clue where Old Meris is. You've got the Dunmer thinking it was to the south, possibly, given some of the implications that we have in the 36 Lessons of Vivec. But I wouldn't be too sure about that, given that the earliest text that we have talking about the search for Old Meris is sending out people in pretty much all directions. And one of the things that does slightly surprise me here is that you will get to talking about the waystones within the text in a bit, but there aren't actually that many directions to go if you just follow the waystone. So I would assume that there were some sailing in explicitly the opposite direction from the waystone as well, but we'll get to that when we get there. And one of the things to flag here, which also comes up later in the text, is that it notices that the orcs are already on Tamriel. This throws quite a serious spanner in the works with the orcs' established timeline, as the Velothi exiles don't leave until the late Middle Merithic Era. And this gets called the Middle Merithic Era. And we have no claims that the Velothi exodus ever predated Topal. So where did these orcs come from? But anyway, back to the text. For centuries, strange crystalline balls were unearthed at the sites of ancient Aldmer shipwrecks and docks, peculiar artifacts of the Merithic and Dawn eras that puzzled archaeologists until it was demonstrated that each had a tendency to rotate on its axis in a specific direction. There were three varieties, one that pointed southward, one that pointed northeast, and one that pointed northwest. And we don't have any indication of how these were created, which we'll get to in a second, but it also feels quite limited in scope, as I say. If they were literally just sending ships south, northeast, and northwest, then they wouldn't have that much of a complete search pattern, if you like, for looking for Old Meris. You wouldn't find it if it was southeast. You wouldn't find it if it was southwest, particularly given Tamriel's geography. So I have to assume that there were other ships that were sent out that were told to sail away from the direction of the Waystones and use them to return home. It's not understood how they work, but they seemed attuned to particular lines of power. These are the Waystones of the Fragment, which each of the pilots used to point their craft in the direction they were assigned to go. A ship with a name not mentioned in the Fragment took his vessel northwest towards Thras and Yokuda. The Pasquiniel took the southern Waystone and must have sailed down towards Pyandonir. Topal and his northeast Waystone found the mainland of Tamriel. And there's part of me that thinks that if there was a ship that headed to Yokuda, are we perhaps looking at the source of the left-handed elves here? That the ship that left Somerset and set up towards Yokuda wound up staying there and perhaps becoming the left-handed elves? That's purely my speculation, by the way, but it's an interesting potential origin for the left-handed elves that I've not seen mentioned anywhere else. It is clear from this fragment what the three ships were assigned to do: find a passage back to Old Elnafay so that the Old Merlau living in Somerset could learn what became of their old homeland. As this book is intended to be a study of Topal the pilot, there is scarcely room to dedicate to different theories of the Old Merry exodus from Old Elnafay. If I were using this poem as my only source, I would have to agree with the scholars who believe in the tradition that several ships left Old Elnafay and were caught in a storm. Those who survived found their way to Somerset Isle, but without their waystones, they did not know what direction their homeland was. After all, what other explanation is there for three ships heading in three opposite directions to find a place? I think the tradition that the ships that left Old Elnafay were caught in a storm is reasonable, although we don't really see it talked about anywhere else. That there's very little evidence that Old Elnafay had this kind of mass exodus. The Marama in particular, I don't think have ever mentioned it in what we've heard from them, and so it's pure conjecture at this point. There are also other possibilities about why they wouldn't necessarily know the place. One of the ones that occurs to me is that those who left Old Elnafay may not have wanted to return. They may not have wanted to let other people know how to get back there. And then there's the idea that Old Elnafay is Tamriel, which we've already talked about. But the explanation of being caught in a storm is a fairly benign way to think about why they wouldn't have got back to Old Elnafay. And the idea of leaving without their waystones is interesting to me as well. Is it possible that waystones were a later innovation that came from Somerset, and so they had no physical way of knowing where they were going to that degree when they left Old Meris? That's a possibility. Given that we don't know that much about the waystones, we can't say either way, but I think it should at least be considered, which this author doesn't really seem to do. Naturally, only one of the ships returned, and we do not know if either or both of the other two found Old Elnafay, or perished at sea or at the hands of the ancient Pyandonians, Slode, or Yokudans. We must assume, unless we think the Aldmer particularly idiotic, that at least one of them must have been pointing in the right direction. It may even have been Topal, and he simply did not go northeast far enough. So, Topal, setting sail from First Hold, heads northeast, which coincidentally is the longest one can travel along the Abekian Sea without striking land of any kind. Had he travelled straight east, he would have struck the mainland somewhere between what is now the Kolovian west of Cyrodiil in a few weeks. Had he travelled southeast, he might have reached the hump of Valenwood in a few days. But our pilot, judging by his own and our modern maps, sailed in a straight line northeast, through the Abyssinian Sea and into the Iliac Bay, before touching ground somewhere near present-day Anticlare in 2 months' time. Now, this doesn't actually match up with what I see in the maps of Tamriel. This isn't actually due northeast from First Hold in order to get there. In order to sail up the Iliac Bay and get to the full extent of the Abyssinian Sea, you have to sail quite a bit north before you turn northeast. So I'm not sure quite what this narrative is saying, if they are indeed saying that they followed the immediate directions of the Waystone from First Hold. You stick a ruler from First Hold going northeast, and you do start hitting points of Valenwood, I think it is. And we've also got a slight typo here as well, or a change in how places are referred to, because you've got Anticlare being talked about here, or Anticlare, one of the two, whereas it's referred to elsewhere as Aleclair, which is the possible birthplace of Hialti Earlybeard or Tiber Septim, depending on who you believe. The rolling verdant hills of southern High Rock are unmistakable in this verse, recognisable to anyone who has been there. The question, of course, is what is to be made of this apparent reference to orcs occupying the region. Tradition has it that the orcs were not born until after the Aldmer had settled the mainland, that they sprung up as a distinct race following the famous battle between Trinimac and Boethia at the time of Rhesdane. It is possible that the tradition is wrong. Perhaps these were accursed folk, Orsimer in the Old Meris, the same word for orc, of a different kind, whose name was to be given the orcs in a different era. It is regrettable that this fragment ends here, for more clues to the truth are undoubtedly lost. Now this is an interesting point of translation actually, because the translator brings up that Orsimer doesn't actually mean orc distinctly, so it's possible that they were actually not the Orsimer, or that we know of as the Orsimer, that they were something else. Exactly what else is up for debate, to be fair, because they couldn't be men, because the men at this point probably hadn't left Atmora if they didn't emerge from Tamriel in the first place, or they were some sort of elf or beast folk that isn't mentioned anywhere else. We don't really have a lot to go on apart from the reference to them being cannibals. It kind of matches how we think of the orcs if we think of the orcs as barbarous savages, but we don't actually know for sure. It's a little frustrating that there isn't much more description to go on here. What's missing between the first fragment and the second is appreciable. It must be more than 80 months that have passed, because Topal is on the opposite side of mainland Tamriel now, attempting to sail southwest to return to Firsthold, after his failure at finding Old Elnafey. Fragment 2. No passage westward could be found in the steely cliffs that jutted up like a giant's jaw, so the Nibben sailed south. As it passed a sandy forest island that promised sanctuary and peace, the crew cheered in joy. Then exultation turned to terror as a great shadow rose from the trees on leathered wings like an unfurling cape. The great bat lizard was large as the ship, but good pilot Topal merely raised his bow and struck it in its head. As it fell, he asked the bosun, "Do you think it's dead?" And before it struck the white-bearded waves, he shot it once more in its heart to be certain, and so for another 40 days and 6, the Nibben sailed south. The text has its own opinion of what the great bat lizard is, but we have sandy forested islands here, which doesn't really chime with what I know of Vardenfell, which is where the text thinks this is going, and that the great bat lizard is in fact a cliff racer. So it's a little weird that that descriptor would have been used. The part of me that wants to feel a little frivolous about this is that it could be a reference to what Icefire Warden later made into the Ecma, which would mean that the islands that they actually hit here were Yinnesley and Eroset, that little chain that's actually quite a way far east of Tamriel. But then you wouldn't have hit the Steely Cliffs quite so quickly. It's a little unclear as to precisely where this is going, although the author definitely has their own opinion on the matter. We can see that in addition to Topal's prowess as a navigator, cartographer, survivalist and raconteur, he is a master of archery. It may be poetic license, of course, but we do have archaeological proof that the Morethic Aldmer were sophisticated archers. Their bows of layers of wooden horn drawn by the silver silk thread are beautiful and still, I've heard excerpts say, millennia later, very deadly. Now these are composite bows, which we see in our own world among charioteers being used before 2000 BC. So if we are equating the ancient Aldmer to ancient civilizations, that gives us a rough frame of reference here, which if we're looking at the kind of boats that were being made then, it's quite a wonder that the Nibben was able to hold as much as it did. The kind of image we have of Topal as, I kind of want to say a Christopher Columbus, but I'm not sure that's quite accurate. But if we have think of him as a Columbus in our heads, then you're thinking of the huge high-sided galleys of the Golden Age of Sail and that sort of thing, which are quite able to contain all the treasures and beasts and furs that are brought back. But if we are equating them to civilizations that are in the thousands BC, in the Stone Age and Iron Age and so on, then the ships will be much more simple, which is a little juxtaposition in the kind of the images being used for Topal as a figure. It is tempting to imagine it a dragon, but the creature that Topal faces at the beginning of this fragment sounds like an ancestor of the cliff racer of present-day Morrowind. The treacherous cliff coastline sounds like the region around Nacrom, and the island of Gorn may be where the nest of the bat lizard is. No creatures like that exist in eastern Morrowind, to my knowledge, at the present day. That's kind of interesting, because you've got vast amounts of cliff racers on Vardenfell, and then St. Jube gets the credit for eliminating them. But if the conclusions drawn by this author are true, then it's possible that the cliff racers were already driving themselves to extinction before the Nereverine arrived, before the Third Era. So it just could be that there's a natural process that the Kaima and Dunmer were just eliminating the cliff racers by their actual presence in the space. It just took longer to have them eliminated on Vardenfell because Vardenfell was for so long a temple precinct with very limited settlement allowed. So it was just the opening up of Vardenfell to trade and exploration and the other forms of mining and so on that the Empire brought that finally eliminated cliff racers who were already on the way out. Fragment 3. The fetid, evil swampland and their human lizards retreated to the east, and Topal and his men's hearts were greatly gladdened by the sight of diamond blue, pure sweet ocean. For 3 days, they sailed in great cheer northwest, where Firsthold beckoned them, but hope died in horror as land, like a blocking shield, rose before them. Topal the pilot was sore wroth, and consulted he the maps he had faithfully drawn, to see whether best to go south, where the continent must end, or take the river that snaked through a passage north. North, he cried to his sad men, north we go, now, fear not, north. Tracing Topal's movements, we see that he skirted the edge of Morrowind and delved into southern Black Marsh, seemingly determined to follow his waystone as best he can. The swamp he is leaving is probably near present-day Gideon. Knowing what we know about Topal's personality, we can understand the frustration in the bay between the Black Marsh and elsewhere. I'm not sure we do actually know that much about Topal's personality, either that or that this author is drawing on oral traditions as well, because remember he said at the start that this is the only text talking about Topal. So either he's building up a picture of Topal that isn't really warranted by these three fragments, or he's relying on an earlier oral tradition as well to fill in the blanks. He's determined from this, sure. He's skilled at arms, sure. But I don't think we can see much else about Topal the person from these particular fragments. Here is a man who follows his orders explicitly and knows that he should have been going southeast through riverways to reach Firsthold. Looking at his maps, we can see that he attempted to find passages through, as he has mapped out the inner sea of Morrowind, and several of the swampy tributaries of Black Marsh, no doubt being turned away by the disease and fierce Argonian tribes that dissuaded many other explorers after him. With a modern map of Tamriel in hand, we can see that he makes the wrong choice in electing to go northeast instead of pushing southward. He could not have known then that what he perceived to be the endless mainland was only a jutting peninsula. He only knew that he had travelled too far southward already, and so he made a smart but incorrect decision to go up the river. This is referring to the overall geography of Tamriel, and it's possibly easier to think about it if you have a look at the map. I will post up a map at writteninuncertainty.com/podcast/father-nibben so that you can see precisely what Topal is facing here and see what routes he could possibly have taken. It's a little hard to keep reading this and keep the map of Tamriel in your mind, but this relies an awful lot on the geography of Tamriel to situate it, and this is kind of key to understanding why he turned back here. It is ironic that his great miscalculation would today bear his mark of history. The bay he thought was an endless ocean is now known as Topal Bay, and the river that took him astray shares the name of his boat, the Nibbon River. And again, this is something that I think must have got beyond cartographers in terms of story, in order for those names to have actually sunk in. Cartographers can call places what they like, but once you have a certain amount of people living there, names need to reach the common folk in order to stick. And so just the dusty maps in First Hold wouldn't have got that far. Fragment 4. The cat demons on four legs and two ran the river's length, always keeping the boat in their green-eyed sight, hissing and spitting and roaring with rage. But the sailors never had to brave the shores, for fruit trees welcomed them, dropping their arms down to the river's edge as if to embrace the myrrh, and the men took fruit quickly before the cat could pounce. For 11 days they travelled north until they came to a crystalline lake and eight islands of surpassing beauty and peace. Brilliant, frightful creatures of glorious colours greeted them in Old Merry language, making the mer wonder until they understood they were only calling back the word that they were speaking, without understanding it, and then the sailors laughed. Topal the pilot was enchanted with the islands and the feathered men who lived there, and the Nibbon stayed for a moon, and the birdmen learned how to speak their own words, and with taloned feet to write. In joy for their new knowledge, they made Topal their lord, giving him their islands for the gift. Topal said he would return some day, but first he must find the passage east of First Hold, so far away. And this is interesting. The birdmen give rise to all sorts of thoughts of what they might be within the community, and particularly with reference to the Aelids, given Umaril's title as the Unfeathered, suggesting that the Heartland High Elves were feathered in some way, or at least wore an awful lot of feathers, typically. Maybe it was an imitation of these birdmen, maybe it was something else, but it kind of muddies the waters a bit when you're trying to think about what they were. And this passage also gives some kind of nods to colonialism and perhaps Columbus a bit more directly, with the impartation of the knowledge to write and speaking words and so on, and then being made a king. It feels very, very like a romanticized version of typical colonial narratives, where the European settlers come and bring wondrous things and they're then fated and celebrated by the natives, who are then wiped out either by disease or guns. There's no real account of that here, but there's part of me that can't help but think, is that something like what's going on here? Was this not exactly the peaceful encounter that is made, given that we have no reference to the birdmen elsewhere? We simply have Topal's own word for it that obviously he's going to conflate, particularly if we're going to draw comparisons with Columbus, who was never really shy about blowing his own trumpet. This last fragment is bittersweet for a number of reasons. We know that this strange, friendly, feathered people that pilot encounters will be lost. In fact, this poem is the only one where mention is made of the bird creatures of Cyrodiil. The literacy that Topal gives them is evidently not enough to save them from their eventual fate, likely at the hands of the cat demons, who we may assume are ancient Khajiiti. Or, to pick up again on the motif of Umaril the Unfeathered, was it possible that the Heartland High Elves wiped them out? We don't really know either way, because they disappear so quickly. We know that Topal and his crew never found a route from the Eight Islands, which are the modern-day Imperial City, through to the Iliac Bay. His maps tell the tale where this lost poem cannot. And this is another iteration that we're just getting fragments of a larger piece of work here, which might actually tell a bit more of a story. Which is a little disappointing that we don't really get it, to be fair, but that's part of the nature of looking at a series which is very deliberately courting the idea of the unreliable narrator. We see his hand as he traces his route up the Nibbon to Lake Rumair, and after attempting a few tributaries which did not lead him where he wanted to go, we can imagine Topal's frustration and that of his long-suffering crew as they return back down the Nibbon to Topal Bay. There, they evidently discovered their earlier mistake, for we see that they passed the peninsula of Elsewhere. Eventually, they travelled along its coastline, past the shores of Valen Wood, and eventually home. Usually, epic tales end with a happy ending, but this one begins with one, and the means to which it was accomplished is lost. Besides the extraordinary bird creatures of present-day Cyrodiil, we've caught glimpses of ancient orcs, perhaps, ancient cliff racers, ancient Argonians, and in this fragment, ancient Khajiit. Quite a history in a few lines of simple verse, all because a man failed to find his home and took all the wrong turns to retrace his steps back. And this is where the text ends. It's a rather fragmentary account of this great first journey, so to speak. And you can see where the author is imposing their own understanding on it, pointing out, finding out the cats on four legs and two are obviously Khajiit, and the lizards and so on are obviously Argonians, which may not necessarily be the case. I don't know what else they may be, but there's the idea that the beast folk are the aboriginals of Tamriel, so to speak. And it's interesting then that the orcs are grouped in as well, because if you think of orcs as beast folk, then you've got all the beast folk being aboriginal to Tamriel, while man and Myr are not. And that's quite an interesting marker, unless we assume that the orcs are in fact something else here, that there's another kind of cursed folk, which isn't really something we have a lot of evidence for, but we don't have much evidence against either. And with that and all that uncertainty, and Topal's inability to find Alnafey, which may not actually exist, I do talk about that in some of my other podcasts, I think we're going to have to leave that one here. Thank you ever so much for joining me through this ramble through the Father of the Nibben. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Please join me again next week, where we will be answering the particular question of what are souls in the Elder Scrolls universe, and how do they work? Until then, this podcast remains a letter written in uncertainty. You've been listening to Written in Uncertainty, a podcast written and presented by Aramithius. The music for this podcast has been kindly provided by Jan Glembotsky and Jeremy Sewell. You can find Jan's work on SoundCloud under Songs from the Lost Land, and Jeremy's Northerner Diaries is available for purchase and on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.
I'm Bob.
And I'm Brad. We're lifelong friends.
And the hosts of the Film and Whiskey Podcast. This is the show where each week we review a classic movie and a glass of whiskey.
That's right. Every week we go in-depth on a well-known movie while sampling the best from the world of scotch, bourbon, and more.
Because nothing goes better with strong opinion than equally strong liquor.
Bob's a movie nerd.
Brad's an average Joe.
But together, we give fresh insights and hot takes on the world of movies and spirits.
So check out the Film and Whiskey Podcast,
part of the Robots Radio Network.
Hey friends, this is Robots, the creator of the Robots Radio Podcast Network and host of the two original shows on the network, the Fallout Lorecast and the Elder Scrolls Lorecast. These two shows have rocketed up the iTunes charts. They both together have over 150 five-star reviews in only a couple of months, with bite-sized episodes that take you step-by-step through the background of the games and the game worlds. They're thought-provoking, well-produced, and a lot of fun. I recommend you go check them out at robotsradio.net or on any podcast, reader, podcatcher, whatever you use, iTunes, Spotify. Again, that's the Fallout Lorecast and the Elder Scrolls Lorecast, available everywhere.
Hello.
Hi.
Do you like bad movies?
Do you find yourself defending bad movies, saying things like, well, the soundtrack was okay, or the costumes were pretty fun?
From the previous hosts of It's Not That Bad podcast, we bring you Fresh Tomatoes, the movie podcast, from Simone LaRue and Chad Ekovitz.
Every week, we review two movies that did not do well critically, but we say, hey, there are some nice things about them. Maybe Rotten Tomatoes was wrong.
Maybe they're all fools, and you should watch these movies regardless. We'll also talk about scenes that could have saved it, and we'll often refer to Simone's cats because they're amazing and adorable, and we love them.
And at the end of each review, we will tell you whether we would watch this movie again, or in what circumstances we would recommend you watch this movie.
So, join us on July 9th for the first drop of our main episode, and then 2 days later for our drop of our minisodes.
And on Robots Radio Podcast Network. Come see us on July 9th. We love you so much already.
Bye! Bye.